would be certain bounds beyond which telescopes could not perform. For the air through which we look upon the stars is in a perpetual tremor, as may be seen by the twinkling of the fixed stars. Newton went on to suggest that a mountaintop might be a good place to put a telescope, and he was right. But even given optimal placement, the atmosphere may not cooperate. Robert W. Duffner, an optics historian at the Air Force Research Laboratory in New Mexico, describes looking at stars through the atmosphere as akin to looking through the frosted glass of a shower stall. You see shapes, but no detail. What happens when a star twinkles? The atmosphere is a tapestry of air patches with different temperatures and densities, and thus different optical properties. Each time a light wave crosses from one patch to another, it bends a little and slightly shifts direction. The scene resembles the fate of pond ripples moving across an untidy ridge of stones, which disturb the smooth shape of each wave crest before it reaches the shore. Under the influence of our undulating atmosphere, a star's image will not only drift to and fro, but will also change in brightness from one moment to the next. A time-lapse photograph will record a smeared circular blob. Your eyes will record a twinkling star. In fully turbulent air, the patches are small and numerous, causing the star to twinkle ferociously. What's needed is a way to compensate for how the varying patches of atmosphere disrupt the starlight. This amounts to reconstructing our pristine pond ripple after it has passed over the rocks. To do this, you'll have to record the light hundreds of times per second. Each time, you'll need sufficient light to simultaneously track and correct for any ongoing atmospheric changes. To facilitate the corrections, you'll need a luminous guide star for comparison, close enough to your target object to be influenced by the same patch of atmosphere at the same time. Alas, such stars are few and far between, unlikely to sit conveniently nearby on the sky. The solution? Create an artificial star. Send a powerful laser beam high above the stratosphere, where turbulence is minimal and there's a continually replenished supply of sodium atoms left behind by vaporized meteors. Excite some of the sodium atoms so that they radiate back at you, and position this now luminous spot exactly where it will serve you best. Before the 1990s, anybody seeking high-resolution images of a star field or galaxy on a twinkle-ridden night had two obvious options. Plan A, close the telescope dome and go to bed. Plan B, raise several billion dollars, build a new telescope, launch it into orbit above the layers of atmospheric disturbance, and observe the universe from there. In 1990, Plan B gave us the Hubble Space Telescope, which offered a leap in resolution from the ground-based telescopes of its day, as impressive as the leap from the unaided eye to Galileo's first telescope. But now there's a less obvious remedy to the twinkling problem. Welcome to the field of adaptive optics. This innovation uses laser guide stars and deformable mirror surfaces to correct for the unwanted twinkling caused by Earth's atmosphere. A matrix of push-pull pistons affixed to the back of a deformable telescope mirror continually adjusts the exact shape in such a way as to correct for the transient atmospheric turbulence, canceling out the patch-to-patch, moment-to-moment atmospheric variations. All adaptive optics systems also include a second non-segmented mirror to monitor and correct the wandering of the image due to larger scale motions in our atmosphere. Rounding out the system components, adaptive optics uses beam splitters, interferometers, monitoring cameras, and of course, specialized software. The whole contraption is costly and complex, It's also strikingly effective, enabling the sharpness of ground-based images to rival that of images taken from space. Did civilian astrophysicists make adaptive optics a reality? No. But that was not for want of trying. From the 1950s onward, astrophysicists developed concepts and potential solutions. But while they were still focusing on possibilities, the U.S. Department of Defense was secretly achieving results. Through classified research funded and conducted from the late 1960s through the late 1980s by organizations such as the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, the Air Force Research Laboratory, and Phillips Laboratory at Kirtland Air Force Base in New Mexico, the Air Force Maui Optical Site, iTech Optical Systems near Hanscom Air Force Base in Massachusetts, the Air Force's Rome Air Development Center in New York, MIT's Lincoln Laboratory, the Visibility Laboratory at Scripps Institution of Oceanography, and the Strategic Defense Initiative. Additional expertise came from the top-secret National Security Science Advisory Group called the JASONS. Formed in 1960 and comprising MacArthur geniuses, Nobel laureates, and prominent academic physicists, the JASONS provide the military with bleeding-edge ideas for how to wage war, end war, and prevent war. From their earliest years of summertime meetings, there have always been a few JASONS whose specialty is the cosmos. It was a JASON who thought up adaptive optics. And it was not until May 27, 1991, that the details of the research were made public. Addressing a packed room at the 178th meeting of the American Astronomical Society that afternoon, Robert Fugate, technical director of the U.S. Air Force's Starfire Optical Range at Kirtland Air Force Base, began his presentation by saying, "Ladies and gentlemen, I'm here to tell you that laser guide star adaptive optics works." Two images of the binary star 53 Ursa Major proved his point. One showed the stellar duo smeared into a single blob of light by the effects of atmospheric turbulence. The other, a beneficiary of adaptive optics, showed two distinctly separate glowing objects. In that moment, Fugate had declassified adaptive optics. Space scientists could now take it to their own next level. The Pentagon's interest in clearer seeing was consistent with the centuries-long military desire for more accurate information, and its interest in laser beacons meshed with the equally long-standing desire for new kinds of weaponry. Cold War thinking dominated U.S. policy during the two decades of groundbreaking adaptive optics research before declassification. Not only did the intelligence community seek sharp images of newly launched enemy satellites, incoming enemy missiles, and troublesome space debris for the sake of space situational awareness, warfighters sought ways of directing powerful lasers at those missiles and satellites for the sake of destroying them. In the early 1970s, sharpening the images could only be done through post-detection digital cleanup of short-exposure films, with deeply unsatisfactory results. Reliance on photographs, scanners, and mainframe computers meant delays of a day or more when measuring wavefronts. The military needed much better technology to provide instant information, and they were prepared to pay for it. The first adaptive optics system for a large telescope was installed in 1982 on the Air Force's satellite tracker at Mount Haleakala on Maui. By then, on the laser front, the military had already seen considerable progress toward controlling and maximizing the intensity of the beam. Building on earlier research, in 1975, the Air Force began to transform an aged Boeing KC-135A into the Airborne Laser Laboratory, which in 1983 succeeded in shooting down a series of air-to-air missiles and ground-launched drones. the use of lasers in airborne anti-missile defense held promise. Ronald Reagan's 1983 public announcement of the Strategic Defense Initiative, Star Wars, promised yet more. With declassification, the divergent goals and tasks of the warfighters and the space scientists came into focus. British-born electrical engineer John W. Hardy, who in 1972 developed the first successful image compensation system to use adaptive optics, described the vast disparity in his 1998 book, Adaptive Optics for Astronomical Telescopes. Equipment for military applications must work reliably under the worst conditions and must produce a specified level of performance, which usually requires advancing the state of the art, an expensive proposition. Astronomers, on the other hand, usually work in good observing conditions and are able to exploit small improvements in technology that allow more information to be extracted from their observations. The defense community must continually push the limits of technology to keep ahead of assumed adversaries. It usually takes some time for the value of new technology to be appreciated and to be applied to scientific work. Some time, in this instance, was less than a decade. By the end of the 1990s, space scientists were already benefiting from the new technology. And today, almost every giant, ground-based, visible light telescope incorporates a version of this corrective system. Unlike other cases in which research progresses via the resonance of ideas, adaptive optics was a baton pass from the warfighter to the astrophysicist. If the capacity to monitor an enemy's movements has always been necessary to military success, what could be more useful to a 21st century spacefaring superpower than the capacity to monitor not only our entire planet, but also the surrounding envelope of space? Since time immemorial, it's been obvious that defense is enhanced by surveillance and reconnaissance, which are enhanced by gaining the high ground. Having gained it, you may then be able to keep it and control it. In 1958, while still a senator, Lyndon B. Johnson called space control the ultimate position. There's something more important than any ultimate weapon. That is the ultimate position, the position of total control over Earth that lies somewhere out in space. That is the distant future, though not so distant as we may have thought. Whoever gains that ultimate position gains control, total control, over the Earth for the purposes of tyranny or for the service of freedom. Given the perennial patterns of unrest in human history, the prospect of any single nation having total control over Earth is unlikely to engender universal confidence. As President Kennedy said in a famous speech delivered to a joint session of Congress in May 1961, just 6 weeks after the Soviet Union's Yuri Gagarin became the first person to orbit Earth, "No one can predict with certainty what the ultimate meaning will be of mastery of space." What's certain is that if the past behavior of nations is any indication of the future behavior of nations, such mastery will not be wholly benign. Benign or otherwise, monitoring to achieve even partial control is standard operating procedure. The U.S. military uses the term situational awareness for the product of its varied forms of monitoring. This awareness is achieved through intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance, ISR, a modern abbreviation for the age-old challenge of knowing what the enemy is up to. Hand in hand with ISR is C3I, command, control, communication, and intelligence. Whatever the acronym, it's clear that neither rulers nor warfighters can make sensible decisions in defense of the nation if they can't quickly muster the facts. That's where satellites come in, because nothing provides more hard facts today than the many hundreds of navigation, remote sensing, also called Earth observation, and weather satellites that now circle Earth 24/7. Take America's Global Positioning System, GPS. 2 dozen satellites in orbit at about 12,500 miles above Earth, more than 50 times higher than ordinary low Earth orbit satellites. You use it to navigate to a cousin's new house 10 miles from nowhere for Thanksgiving dinner. Geologists use it to chart earthquake fault zones in western India. Conservation biologists use it to track the tagged grizzly bear population in Alberta, Canada. And people looking for immediate sex use it to triangulate on potential partners within range of their own location. GPS is everybody's handy helper. You probably wouldn't guess that it was created for the U.S. Department of Defense and is controlled by the Air Force Space Command. Civilians can use GPS, but the navigation data they're given is less precise than what is supplied to military interests. People in other countries use it too, but there's no ironclad guarantee of their having permanent access irrespective of changes in the political situation. Then there are, and were, the satellites in America's Defense Support Program, the Defense Meteorological Satellite Program, the Defense Satellite Communications System, the Missile Defense Alarm System, the Space-Based Infrared System, the Military Strategic and Tactical Relay System, the Galactic Radiation and Background Program, all the various classified and declassified satellites whose ISR capabilities our multiple defense agencies rely on. Military satellites have been around for half a century, sent aloft shortly after the Soviet Union alarmed the United States by putting the first artificial satellite, Sputnik 1, into orbit on October 4, 1957. From the early days of spaceflight, ISR formed a major chunk of the agenda. America's Corona missions, beginning in August 1960, and the Soviet Union's Zenit missions, beginning in April 1962, were Cold War spies that took hundreds of thousands of photographs, although both programs were given a civilian, scientific face and a different name for public consumption. The high-altitude cameras of today's Earth observation satellites are useful for the planning of roads and the monitoring of hurricanes, for locating ancient ruins swallowed up by sand or jungle, and for routing disaster assistance to villages cut off by fires, floods, landslides, or earthquakes. Most of them are mounted on satellites that orbit our planet somewhere between 200 miles and 22,000 miles overhead. The same or similar cameras that are used to surveil dwindling forests and shrinking glaciers can be used to surveil adversaries. Most satellites, in fact, are dual use. And if, as Joan Johnson Freeze of the U.S. Naval War College points out, dual use covers both civilian, military, and defensive, offensive uses, then space technology is at least 95% dual use. India, for example, has a satellite called TESS, Technology Experiment Satellite, which has orbited at an altitude of about 350 miles since late 2001. Asked whether TESS's optical camera, sharp enough for 1 meter resolution of Earth's surface, was intended for spying, the chairman of the Indian Space Research Organization responded, "It will be for civilian use consistent with our security concerns. All Earth observation satellites look at the Earth. Whether you call it Earth observation or spying, it is a matter of interpretation. If one high-res remote sensing satellite is good, two are even better." In the spring of 2009, India's space agency launched ReSat-2. An Israeli-built satellite with all-weather, round-the-clock radar sensing suitable for monitoring both crops and borders. On the question of its uses, the Times of India quoted a senior Indian space official as saying, "It will be primarily used for defense and surveillance." The satellite also has good application in the area of disaster management and in managing cyclones, floods, and agriculture-related activities. Undistracted by his references to natural disasters, the Times editors titled this report, "India to Launch Spy Satellite on April 20th. Uncountable changes have taken place since Galileo offered the Doge a 9-power spyglass. He could not have foreseen what this monitoring device would turn into. He could not have conceptualized the planetary reach of the telescope's orbiting cousins. But knowing the value of early access to information, he might have been pleased to learn that his name would be attached to the European Union's own emergent global navigation satellite system. While being interoperable with GPS, as well as with Russia's equivalent system, GLONASS, Galileo will circumvent what was once U.S. military control of information essential to all. As the agency that oversees the system states, with Galileo, users now have a new, reliable alternative that, unlike these other programs, remains under civilian control. Control, but not exclusive use. In 2016, the author of a report on the security aspects of the European Union's space capabilities said that while Galileo and Copernicus, the EU's Earth observation satellite system, aid in such essentials as coordinating aerial transport and tracking changes in the atmosphere, we should not be afraid to say that they can also serve the common security and defense policy. Aside from facing the threats ceaselessly devised by our fellow Earthlings, all these eyes in the sky are vulnerable to a naturally occurring adversary. Space weather. Unbeknownst to 19th century electric telegraph operators and everyone else then living on Earth, the sun is a giant ball of magnetic plasma that occasionally flares, ejecting blobs of charged particles across interplanetary space. In 1859, the biggest plasma pie in the past 500 years hit Earth, mysteriously disrupting the world's newborn telegraph systems. The blast was so intense that it merited a name, the Carrington Event, after the English solar astronomer Richard Carrington, who was the first to observe it. Today, with hundreds of military and communication satellites orbiting Earth and widespread grids feeding our electrically hungry civilization, we are more susceptible than ever to such a burst. In response, power companies are hardening their electronics at major switching stations. And the European Space Agency, Natural Resources Canada, and America's National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration now have teams whose sole job is to monitor and predict space weather. These predictions will make it possible to switch satellites to safe mode in advance of a solar storm, thereby protecting their electric circuitry from an onslaught of charged particles. In a now famous 1961 speech, outgoing President Dwight D. Eisenhower described historical episodes of wartime production, say the ramping up of optical glass making during World War I, as the part-time temporary making of swords by the usual makers of plowshares, in contrast with the full-time making of armaments that had become standard practice by his time in office. The novelist John Dos Passos had already memorably warned America about the military financial complex with a pointed reference to the wealth of J.P. Morgan. Wars and panics on the stock exchange, machine gun fire and arson, bankruptcies, war loans, good growing weather for the House of Morgan. Now Eisenhower warned America about the military-industrial complex, the underbelly of necessary cooperation among political, scientific, defense, and productive forces. Not the first to issue such warnings, but certainly the highest-profile person to do so. He referred to unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, and to the prospect of domination of the nation's scholars by federal employment, project allocations, and the power of money. Wanting to have it both ways, Eisenhower also declared that America's armaments must be mighty, ready for instant action. He worried that America's citizenry might not keep itself well informed enough to guarantee the proper meshing of the huge industrial and military machinery of defense with our peaceful methods and goals. Take this meshed military-industrial machinery, add the race for ever higher high ground, factor in the skyrocketing profit margins invoked by Dos Passes, and you've birthed the military-space-industrial complex, aerospace. Not many commentators have summed it up better than the fictional Madison Avenue creative director Don Draper of the AMC hit television series Mad Men, voicing a view that would have been current in late 1962. Every scientist, engineer, and general is trying to figure out a way to put a man on the moon or blow up Moscow, whichever one costs more. We have to explain to them how we can help them spend that money. Congressmen are the customers. They want aerospace in their districts. Let them know that we can help them bring those contracts home. 7.5 centuries have now passed since Roger Bacon informed the Pope that enemy armies could be seen at a distance with the aid of transparent bodies. Bacon's carefully shaped, suitably arranged, refracting bodies have been replaced by a staggering portfolio of detectors, ranging from night vision goggles to space telescopes. Seeing has become situational awareness and now encompasses a vast swath of wavelengths well beyond the merely visual. Distances are now measured in light years rather than stadia. Yet a few armed zealots can now cause more havoc and destruction than entire armies once did. And the future of weaponry may pivot not on how many guided missiles live in your silo, but on how many cyber scientists work in your lab. One factor that hasn't changed is money. Another is the existence and creation of enemies. The Ultimate High Ground. Chapter 5. Unseen, Undetected, Unspoken. Invisibility captivates the astrophysicist and the warfighter. Both engage in surveillance. With the aid of a telescope, astrophysicists, in pursuit of knowledge, probe the otherwise non-visible cosmos at ever greater depths and ever greater distances. Warfighters, in pursuit of defense or dominance, probe the enemy's hidden systems while seeking their own invisibility, gaining control while staying out of harm's way. Besides the pursuit of knowledge, defense, and dominance, there's the pursuit of secrecy. Specifically, the secrecy of information, yet another side of invisibility. For most of human history, we understood the world through our 5 senses. Sight, smell, taste, touch, and hearing gave us encyclopedic amounts of data. There was no particular reason to think that vast quantities of unseen, unheard, untouched, and generally unsensed objects and phenomena might be crammed into the world as well. Eventually, the telescope and the microscope cracked open the door to the invisible, yielding extraordinary revelations. An incredible number of little animals of diverse kinds, several thousands in one drop, of Earth's water, rills in the moon, spots on the sun, rings around Saturn. Even so, during the first few centuries, the microscope and telescope deepened human vision only within that narrow band of the electromagnetic spectrum called visible light, enabling us to see better than ever before, but only seeing the same kind of light we were already accustomed to seeing. Yes, we could now detect dimmer things, smaller things, more distant things, but we hadn't yet grasped that much of the physical universe would require means of detection completely different from what our eyes, ears, and skin can provide. What separates great scientists from ordinary scientists is not the capacity to answer the right question. It's the capacity to ask the right question in the first place, and not let common sense dictate or constrain their thinking. Fact is, there's nothing common about what you never knew existed. The formidable English physicist Isaac Newton, for instance, questioned the fundamentals of light and color. Everyone assumed that color was an intrinsic property of, say, the raindrops in a rainbow, or the crystal pendants of a chandelier. Who in their right mind would have thought that ordinary light, white light, was composed of colors at all? Newton, however, was smart enough to make no assumptions. By directing a ray of sunlight through a glass prism which caused the visible spectrum to emerge from it and then reversing the sequence, sending the spectrum back through the prism whereupon white light emerged, he convincingly demonstrated that white light is indeed composed of multiple colors. Although each color in the spectrum shades gradually into its neighbor, Newton, a proponent of cosmic orderliness and the mystically significant number 7, declared there were not 6 colors, as most of us today might list, but 7, slotting indigo between blue and violet to round out the set. As early as the summer of 1672, decades before publishing his great work Optics, or A Treatise of the Reflections, Refractions, Inflections, and Colors of Light, Newton sent a letter to the Royal Society with a list of questions about light and color that could be properly answered only through experiments. Two of his earliest queries were whether rays, which are endued with particular degrees of refrangibility when they are by any means separated, have particular colors constantly belonging to them, and whether a due mixture of rays endued with all variety of colors produces light perfectly like that of the sun and which hath all the same properties, his prism experiment would answer yes to both. Might Newton also have wondered, just once, even for a moment, whether there might exist some other adjacent bands of light that our eyes could not see? He had noticed that red, on one end of the visible spectrum, and violet, on the other end, both just faded away to darkness. He had raised the further possibility of there being other original properties of the rays of light besides those already described. Perhaps most important, he was comfortable with the idea of hidden attributes, yet optics offers no clear evidence that he ventured there. In any case, a century would come and go before anyone conceived an answer to that unstated query. Turned out, there were multiple answers. One came early in 1800, when the English astronomer William Herschel, the man who had discovered the planet Uranus 2 decades earlier, explored the relation between sunlight, color, and heat. As Newton had so often done, Herschel began by placing a prism in the path of a sunbeam, but took it a step further. To determine whether each color had a different temperature, he placed thermometers in the various regions of the rainbow cast by the prism. And like any good scientist conducting a well-designed experiment, he placed a controlled thermometer outside the color range, adjacent to the red side of the spectrum, to measure the ambient air temperature unaltered by the warmth of the sunbeam. Herschel did indeed discover that different colors registered different temperatures, but that turned out to be the second most interesting result of his experiment. The control thermometer sitting in darkness, registered an even higher temperature than any of the thermometers placed within the rainbow. Only invisible rays could have caused that warming. Sir William had discovered infrared light, the band just below red. His finding was the astronomy equivalent of geologists discovering the colossal Nubian aquifer beneath the sands of the Eastern Sahara. Behold his account of it. By several experiments, it appears that the maximum of illumination has little more than half the heat of the full red rays, and from other experiments, I likewise conclude that the full red falls still short of the maximum of heat, which perhaps lies even a little beyond visible refraction. In this case, radiant heat will at least partly, if not chiefly, consist, if I may be permitted the expression, of invisible light, that is to say, of rays coming from the sun that have such a momentum as to be unfit for vision. The following year, 1801, Johann Wilhelm Ritter, a German scientist whose main interest was the intersection of electricity and chemistry, picked up where Herschel left off. Philosophically attracted to the concept of polarity in nature, Ritter assumed that infrared must have a companion just off the other side of the visible spectrum. Rather than use thermometers to demonstrate its presence, he used silver chloride, a substance known to decompose and darken at different rates when exposed to different colors of light. Ritter's experiment, like Herschel's, was both simple and smart. He placed a small mound of silver chloride in each visible color, as well as in the unlit area alongside the violet, then awaited the results. As expected, the pile in the unlit patch darkened even more than the pile in the violet patch. What's more violet than violet? Ultraviolet. Detecting without seeing was now a scientific reality. Skywatching didn't change overnight, though. The first telescope capable of detecting wavelengths outside the slim visible portion of the electromagnetic spectrum wasn't built for another 130 years, well after the German physicist Heinrich Hertz had shown that the only real difference among the different kinds of light is the amount of energy they carry. And that would ultimately include it all. Radio waves, microwaves, infrared, Roy G. Biv, ultraviolet, X-rays, and gamma rays. In other words, he figured out that there is such a thing as an electromagnetic spectrum, a symphony of vibrating waves, each with a unique wavelength, frequency, and energy. To the astrophysicist, it's all energy, it's all radiation, it's all light. Sometimes light behaves like particles, which we call photons. Sometimes, in fact most times in our daily lives, light behaves like waves. Whether light should be conceptualized as waves or particles is an old disagreement. Democritus argued with Aristotle about it. Newton argued with Huygens, and quantum physics says it's both. Hence, we're stuck with the phrase wave-particle duality, even though our brains have a hard time wrapping themselves around the concept. Unfortunately, the word wavicle never caught on. For now, think of light, electromagnetic radiation, is made up of waves made of particles. The word wavelength obviously applies to waves. It's the simple measure of length from crest to crest or trough to trough. Gamma ray wavelengths are shorter than the diameter of an atom. On the far end of the radio band, wavelengths can be longer than the diameter of Earth. The shorter the wavelength, the higher the energy, and broadly speaking, the greater the danger to life as we know it. And whether we're exploiting the electromagnetic spectrum for saintly or nefarious reasons, the shorter the wavelength, the higher the density of information that can be carried by the light beam. Without technological assistance, garden-variety humans see only the tiniest fraction of the full electromagnetic spectrum, ranging from violet light, with a wavelength of about 400 nanometers, to red light, with a wavelength not quite twice as long, about 700 nanometers. When you consider that the bands of the electromagnetic spectrum we've measured so far span more than a dozen powers of 10 in wavelength, our span of barely a single power of 2 is just plain lame. Crucially for us, the peak of the sun's energy output lies smack in the middle of the visible part of the spectrum. Since we're daytime creatures, it's evolutionarily sensible that the detection capacity of our eyes peaks in the same place. Infrared and ultraviolet are invisible to us, but that doesn't mean they're insensible. We experience them through our skin, not our eyes. We sense the sun's infrared light in real time as heat on our skin, but we sense its ultraviolet light only after our skin has been darkened and perhaps damaged by excessive exposure, otherwise known as sunburn. Earth itself radiates infrared, as does everything whose molecules are in motion, be it animate or inanimate. In other words, anything and everything with a temperature above absolute zero. Dusty galactic clouds, where stars form deep within, emit infrared. Your kitten, your canary, and your houseplants, dead or alive, all emit infrared. Some species of snakes have small pits on their heads that pick up infrared rays from tasty warm-blooded prey readily revealed at night against the rapidly cooling surroundings. And alas, for the hotel industry and tourists the world over, the antennae of bed bugs have infrared sensors that alert the bugs to a nearby source of warm blood. As for ultraviolet, flying insects, including gnats, moths, mosquitoes, and butterflies, as well as birds, bats, rats, and cats, see it quite well. Just because an object emits infrared doesn't mean it can readily be seen by an infrared detector. You still have to single out your target from any competing sources of infrared light either surrounding your target or surrounding you. Anything warmer than its surroundings shows up brighter. But if the target is about the same temperature, you'll lose it in the infrared noise. Sky watchers improve their capacity to detect their chosen infrared target by deeply cooling their apparatus with liquid nitrogen, 77 kelvins, or, for the coolest cases, liquid helium, 4 kelvins. These tamp down the thermal noise of the detector itself, permitting the celestial object to shine more distinctly in the data. As you might suspect, the needs of the military aviator are the exact opposite. If targeted by a heat-seeking missile, the plane or helicopter will typically deploy infrared countermeasures such as swirling hot flares, which contribute infrared noise to what the warhead sees, and thus render the engine's hot exhaust indistinguishable from the countermeasures themselves. Infrared and ultraviolet merely hint at all the light energy we humans cannot see. Further along on the long wavelength, low energy end of the electromagnetic spectrum are radio waves, experimentally demonstrated in the 1880s, and microwaves, named as the small end subset of radio waves in 1964 through 1965, hence the diminutive prefix micro. Further along in the other direction on the short wavelength, high energy end are X-rays, discovered in 1895, and gamma rays in 1900. Though we've assigned labels to the various bands, the electromagnetic spectrum is a continuum. Civilization is layered along this continuum. Hundreds of AM, FM, and XM stations are beaming radio waves through your body right now. The phone part of your smartphone is communicating in microwaves with a cell phone tower, and the map features of your smartphone are talking to GPS satellites overhead via microwaves, too. You're probably receiving visible light from a nearby lamp and, if its bulb is incandescent, infrared light as well. Meanwhile, across the universe, an ancient, persistent, pervasive sea of microwave radiation forms the cosmic microwave background, a legacy of the Big Bang. Most celestial goings-on emit light in multiple wavelengths simultaneously. For example, the explosion of a massive star, a supernova, is a cosmically commonplace, though locally rare, and seriously high-energy event that, in addition to visible light, blasts out prodigious quantities of X-rays. Sometimes, the explosion is accompanied by a burst of gamma rays or a flash of ultraviolet. When it takes place in our own galaxy, it may emit so much light in visible wavelengths that it remains visible for several weeks without the aid of a telescope, as was true of the supernova spectaculars hosted by the Milky Way in 1572 and 1604. Long after the explosive gases cool, the shock waves dissipate, and the visible light fades, a supernova remnant radiates infrared and radio waves. The flip side of visibility is detection. When it comes to the pursuit of prey or, conversely, the avoidance of enemies, detection is key to both conquest and survival. Whether you're the victim or the aggressor, never is it more advantageous not to see something than to see it. Either way, but especially if you're the likely victim, you would prefer not only to see the aggressor, but also to remain unseen yourself. Camouflage. A word of French origin whose earlier meanings ranged from smoke and suffocating underground explosions to costume disguises and criminal sneakiness. The art of remaining unseen is not uncommon among creatures big and small. Think of the kaleidoscopic changes of the cuttlefish or octopus, the twig-like insect known as the walking stick, or, before the melting induced by climate change, the polar bear's snowy fur against the whiteness of the Arctic snowpack. Camouflage can be about either keeping yourself from getting eaten or closing in on your own dinner. There's also the distinction proposed early in the 20th century by an American artist named Abbott Thayer between two very different forms of visual camouflage, blending versus dazzling. Nature has chosen the option of blending for both the widespread walking stick and the threatened polar bear. Critters that live in woodsy habitats might blend in by being green on green or speckly brown on speckly brown, while others might dazzle and confuse observers with vivid stripes, prominent spots, or other garish markings that have the effect of breaking up the outlines of their bodies and making them more difficult to track while in motion. In all cases, the goal is to vanish. Invaders and warfighters love camouflage and stealth, the nearest they can get to invisibility, and they've been attempting it for millennia. In the 5th century BC, the military theorist Sun Tzu advised, "All warfare is based on deception. Hence, when able to attack, we must seem unable. When using our forces, we must seem inactive. When we are near, we must make the enemy believe we are far away. When far away, we must make him believe we are near." 10 centuries later, Flavius Vegetius Renatus, a prominent Roman court official and author of a military handbook, described traditional camouflage for the scouting craft that accompanied large warships for the purpose of making surprise attacks, intercepting enemy convoys, and monitoring the approaching enemy, so that the scouting vessels will not be betrayed by brightness, The sails are dyed Venetian blue, similar to the color of the sea, and the tackle is colored with the wax that ships are generally coated with. Also, the sailors and marines wear Venetian blue colored clothing so that not only at night, but also in the daytime, they more easily remain unseen while scouting. Though the sea continually changes color, at a distance, the ship's blue coloration could, under optimal conditions, merge with that of the water. Only at close range would the difference between their Venetian blue and the varied blues, browns, greens, and grays of the sea be readily perceptible. But once the difference had registered, there wouldn't be enough time to organize an attack against the scouts. Distance buys time and advantage, which was precisely Galileo's point when he sought support from the Doge of Venice in 1609. A few other proposals for maritime camouflage were more imaginative than a coat of Venetian blue. One early 20th century alternative, never implemented, involved swathing ships in billowing white covers meant to simulate clouds. Cladding troops and vehicles with branches and leaves to simulate forest foliage is another time-honored type of camouflage. Whether in the guerrilla warfare of 20th century Vietnam or in medieval Scotland, recall the dire prophecy in Shakespeare's Macbeth, "Fear not till Birnam Wood do come to Dunsinane." But not until World War I, when artists began to paint unrolled canvas to look like roads and observation posts to look like tree trunks, did the word camouflage officially enter the English language. Soon, the practice of painting whole warships in a dazzled pattern, also called disruptive patterning or, much snazzier, razzle-dazzle, was adopted on both sides of the Atlantic. The deciding factor seems to have been the sinking of almost 1,000 British ships by Germany's U-boats during the first 9 months of 1917, causing a British painter of seascapes, who was serving as a naval officer, to propose that since it was impossible to paint a ship so that she could not be seen by a submarine, the extreme opposite was the answer. In other words, to paint her in such a way as to break up her form and thus confuse a submarine officer as to the course on which she was heading. Creating confusion seemed a better solution than trying to attain invisibility. Suddenly, artists became facilitators of military goals, as warriors picked up some of the disintegrationist, scientistic visual strategies of the vanguard movements of cubism, futurism, and vorticism. Picasso and Braque, the fathers of cubism, were delighted to see what they regarded as their aesthetic invention being applied to ships and weaponry. Walking down a boulevard in Paris one evening and seeing a convoy of zigzag-painted heavy guns heading for the front, Picasso reportedly exclaimed, "We invented that." Franklin D. Roosevelt himself, Assistant Secretary of the U.S. Navy during World War I, is said to have shouted after being shown a bedazzled test ship, "How the hell do you expect me to estimate the course of a goddamn thing all painted up like that?" In the end, though, standardized, dazzle camouflage apparently did not live up to its promise. Attacks proceeded at similar rates on ships with and without such a coating. Nevertheless, despite plenty of evidence to the contrary, magical thinking about the efficacy of disruptive camouflage persisted through World War II and beyond. Several options for disappearing from the visible part of the spectrum have a long wartime pedigree. The simplest is to exploit the darkness of night. Another is to blind the enemy. Set a huge bonfire, and enemy forces who look at it will be unable to see anything other than flames, and therefore be unable to target you with any precision. In recent decades, both lasers and smokescreens have been used to blind the enemy. Throw a white phosphorus grenade at your target, and you'll get an instant smokescreen that will also scorch whoever is in the vicinity while it masks your own maneuvers and your own infrared radiation. Blinding also happens to us in the universe when the light of a host star swamps the much fainter reflected light of its exoplanets. This was a big problem until a couple of decades ago, when space scientists began using a special occulting disc in their telescope's optics to block out the offending starlight, thus achieving the opposite of what a telescope was invented to accomplish. Another very different approach to disappearance is transparency, embodied in the clear glass window. Flies, moths, birds, and visitors from outer space who don't know about windows must be baffled by the interposition of something visually imperceptible but impenetrable between themselves and the scenery. But let's say you want to move around at will, unobtrusively, rather than be locked in place like a window, yet also be functionally invisible. Nowadays, you could coat yourself in a foam, fiber, or powder that reflects no light. An adversary would be prevented from illuminating you, although you would still block the scenery behind your position, and a clever hunter would be able to detect you by the exact absence of your human form rather than its presence. You could also cloak yourself in scales or mirrors that redirect the light that hits you, sending little or none of it back to the source, similar to the design principle of stealth aircraft, which redirect incident radar on their fuselage back out in many different directions. Another quite recent option is a fabric made of tiny light-transmitting beads that can transpose an image from behind you to in front of you. To an observer, it's as though you're not there at all, the same effect as donning a Star Trek cloaking device. Other possibilities. If you're an architect designing an offensively gargantuan skyscraper, you could cover it in LEDs that project the surrounding scenery minus its presence. If you're a spy monitoring the doorway down the street, you might want to vanish into thin air, magician style, via a clever sequence of lenses or mirrors placed between yourself and the doorway. Achieving invisibility through temporary camouflage is an intuitive, imaginative tactic with limited reliability. Achieving invisibility through stealth is a scientific tactic grounded in an understanding of the physical laws of reflection and refraction, as well as on centuries' worth of discoveries about the many forms of light energy to which our senses have no access. By the end of the 19th century, we could no longer delude ourselves into believing that the universe communicates with us only through the narrow band of light available to the human retina. With the discovery of multiple bands of light, it became unthinkable to design a defense strategy solely around visible light or to explain the cosmos solely on the basis of observations done in visible light, like composing a symphony from only a single octave's span of notes. A new term was needed: astrophysics, as distinct from astronomy, to clarify the difference between identifying the presence and position of celestial bodies and the more convoluted process of ascertaining their components, their mass, their paths, and their history. Light would become an encyclopedia. The effort to detect things too dim to register on the human eye would become the longest-running show in astrophysics. All this required new technology and new techniques. The astrophysicist sought detectors capable of capturing every wavelength. The warfighter sought offensive systems capable of exploiting those wavelengths and defensive systems capable of eluding them. the radio band felt like a good bet to both sides. For the military, pre-nukes, it became nearly indispensable. For space scientists, it offered new avenues to new information. Working together, they helped shape the course of World War II.